All right, we are in Windows World with some familiar faces. Martin Lovell, we haven't seen you for about 10 years.
It's good to be back.
It's great to have you back. And Elliot, Eho is what we call you, but yep. Go ahead. And last time we talked to you was about audio stuff in Windows 7.
Yes.
And you guys have been working on a very interesting project that's released in Windows 8, the Windows Runtime. So I wanted to come and talk to you and get some details, some historical perspectives, kind of dig into how it all works. So let's begin at the beginning. What's the story of the Windows Runtime as far as your involvement?
So the story actually starts in Windows 7. So we were in the same big group inside Windows, and I helped start an architecture group in that, and many of the architects in half of Windows met once a week during all of Windows 7. And a constant theme that came up on that was the programming model for Windows and Windows apps, and you know, what runtime system was better than others, and we discussed COM and NanoCom and other typical runtime systems inside and outside of Windows. And we actually talked about this blue sky for 2 years at least. And that architecture group actually was the genesis of Martin's team. Martin was the dev manager, and I was an architect in that team. And three of the members of that architecture group from Windows 7 became three of the senior people inside of Martin's team, which the charter of which was to reimagine the programming model in Windows. And actually, Alesh came to you, so I guess you can talk about how that...
We had all tried to build platforms in Windows 7. We'd all tried to move the Windows platform forward during Windows 7 based on what we already had. You know, we had COM, we had Win32, we had DirectX, which was kind of half COM and half not. We had these pieces, and each of us was trying to do something new. In my team, we were working on user interface. Eho was working on things in multimedia. We're all trying to say, how can we bring the platform forward? We're all running into pretty fundamental problems. We had managed code, and we had native code, and they were different, and we ended up needing two different sets of stuff for that. We had a user experience that was very bad for developers when they worked with C++, and much better for developers when they worked with managed code, and that seemed to stack the deck in a certain way. And so the developers weren't getting a very good experience across all the different languages in the Windows 7 timeframe, and all of us were kind of struggling with that. As architects trying to think about the Windows platform, we wanted people to have a great experience across all the different languages, and we just couldn't get to that without tons of really duplicative work in Windows 7. Mm. And so as we started thinking about Windows 8, and we started thinking, well, we're also going to bring JavaScript to the table, we're going to bring HTML, CSS, JavaScript-based apps to the table, as well as all this other stuff, that started to seem like we were going to end up multiplying things even further and making even more expense and complexity around for developers. And so when we started Windows 8, we started to say, well, what is it we could do to make it so that the Windows team builds one set of platform, builds one set of services, and they're available to developers no matter what technology they choose at a higher level, so that there is one technology for all of those things, and that's what became the ideas of the Windows Runtime.
Excellent.
I mean, for example, one of the problems that we've had traditionally with .NET and Windows is Windows would ship a platform, Vista or Windows 7, and then some amount of months or years later, probably months, they would ship pinvoke wrappers for whatever we did in Windows. And that technology was imperfect and lagged and actually didn't create an experience inside of .NET that composed well with the rest of their platform until probably years later when they actually built proper manifestations or wrappers or whatever you want to call them in sort of .NET, so it looked like a natural part of the platform. So we, one of our dreams at the very beginning is that we would build parts of Windows that would be available to developers, and then that it would appear to developers in a natural and familiar way on the day that we shipped our platform.
Right, that's a key goal of the Windows Runtime, that we don't have to depend on the developer tools adopting our stuff in a later step. You know, I had worked in a long distant past on MFC, which is one of those old style wrapper technologies, and it took the MFC team, even though they were very smart people working very hard, many, many years to catch up with all the Windows API innovations that were happening. And so we were isolating developers outside of Microsoft from the ability to get to the platform in the right way they wanted to early on in the cycle. Instead, they had to wait that long delay for .NET to catch up, for MFC to catch up, for something else to catch up. And that delay meant that people were unable to use the platform with the speed that we thought they needed to in this kind of fast-moving age of rapidly evolving platforms.
Absolutely. Now, you know, in some sense, you know, a lot of Win32 apps have been written over the years. There's millions of them. So, you know, desktop applications are, you know, were desktop developers asking for a simplified model? I'm sure they would have loved to have XAML, you know, rather than MFC, let's be honest. And so, you know, basically that's my question. So you already have a group of developers, they call themselves desktop developers. We like to, as developers, isolate ourselves and name ourselves. Then you had .NET developers, or people who run at a higher level. They have a virtual machine, memory management, very rich set of capabilities in the base class library. And WPF for them on the desktop. Anyway, the question that I'm trying to spit out is, as you thought about this at the high level, how did you arrive at the Windows runtime? Well, how did you arrive at what we have today? Based on all these other developers that already exist.
We had done, I think, in the 2000s, a pretty good job for .NET for managed developers. A lot of those folks were pretty happy. There was a great IntelliSense experience. They had a great new UI platform type in XAML. They had great tools for accessing web services. And across the board, there was a good job done there. But as someone who spent a lot of time at developer conferences in the 2000s, you would speak to lots of other people as well who weren't in the .NET world. And those people were either C++ people who were like, well, I have MFC, but I don't want to build my UI that way. I'd like to build my UI this new way. Why won't you let me into the party? Mm-hmm. And I worked on our kind of first approach to that, which was C++/CLI, which was a managed version of C++, which didn't work out super well, but was good for a few things. And then you'd run into all these people. I interview at colleges for a lot, and they know about HTML and JavaScript and CSS, and they'd be like, Win32 platform, what's that? You know, they had a whole different set of approaches. And so we saw that we were doing a great job for this .NET people, but the other two sides of the people, we were just not really reaching them at all in a great way in the 2000s. And so we wanted to try and reach out to both those different sets of people. And that's a really different set of requirements. For the HTML folks, they want to use HTML markup. They're used to JavaScript. It's a dynamic language. It's a language typed in a very different way to C++. Mm-hmm. And at the other end of the spectrum, the classic desktop developer has been kind of trapped in the Win32 user APIs for a very long time with no UI platform innovation there, even though we've invented some really cool, powerful UI technologies in XAML. And so both those folks need to be brought into the fold while not undermining the great experience we've built for .NET folks. You know, we have great stuff for .NET. We thought, how can we bring all that greatness we made in .NET out to all three languages while generating only one set of platform technologies that reaches all those three sets of developers? And that's the customer genesis of building the Windows runtime.
Awesome.
So now let me set the stage. It's the end of Windows 7. I'm bad remembering dates, but this is circa 2009. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is we want to create a new developer platform, new API surface, and we have to serve a dynamic loosely typed language, which is JavaScript. We have to take a, which also has a garbage collector. We have to take a garbage collected .NET language, and then we have to service native. It felt like one of those be careful what you wish for kinds of situations, like, okay, now what do we do?
We felt like we'd be pretty busy. And actually, that was the, as a manager, so I was put in the position of being the manager leading this new team. And my first constraint on the problem was, well, we're going to ship Windows in about 3 years. You know, we didn't have a date yet, but we knew it was about 3 years away. And I had been around in developer division when we built the .NET platform for the first time. And I've been around seeing booting of various other developer platform technologies. And I kind of knew that that wasn't enough time to do what we had done before and kind of start everything from scratch. You know, you can sit a bunch of smart people in a conference room and say, should int be 16 bits, 32 bits, 64 bits, 57 bits, and have that conversation. And you can do all of those conversations. It takes a very long time to do that. And we knew we didn't kind of have time to go back to first principles on absolutely everything in the universe. And simultaneously, we have all these friends in Windows who work on different parts of Windows, and they have existing code, and they're also working on designing a new user interface and new device technologies and new multimedia technologies and all that other stuff. And so all that is going on at the same time. So we need a way to get them going pretty quickly. So the conjunction of those two things means we have to start from something that partially already exists. We can't afford to take the blank slate approach and take what we thought would be a 5 or 6 year project. We needed a project that was going to be ready for a developer conference 2 years later and ready for coding by Windows developers 1 year later. And so we said, okay, what's a starting point of some technology in Windows that we can adapt and gradually morph to what we need? And that led us to take the fundamental decision that IronKnown and the foundation of COM was the right way to build upon to get to the WinRT.
Interesting.
But this was not the COM that...
this is not your grandmother's COM, as we say.
This is not your grandfather's COM.
Yes.
So in the beginning, after we made this kind of important platform and technology decision, we wrote a paper a really long time ago about basically what we wanted out of our new platform, or what we didn't like about COM. Am I allowed to say that?
Yes. There were many things we didn't like about COM.
And so one of the things that was key in that long ago paper was we wanted this to be really class-based. Not co-classes, but really class-based, as opposed to interfaces. Now, we couldn't just throw interfaces out of COM, but we wanted the experience to be about classes, because that was one of the really great things about the experiences of .NET, is you talk to classes rather than interfaces. And the other thing is that COM has never had namespaces, and therefore it never really had any notion of what we came to be string-based activation. So the whole thing about class IDs, they're mostly gone. They're a low-level internal detail inside of the guts of WinRT, but basically the programming surface never sees a class ID. And so we ended up, through lots and lots and lots of discussions, ended up building this thing we call runtime classes, which are composed of a fixed set of known interfaces that are described in metadata, which got invented a little bit later. And so you can walk up to a runtime class and definitively know what it implements. You may or may not care about what interfaces make up that runtime class, but you can walk up and know. And so we actually had to build a new low-level interface, which derives from IronKnown, which eventually became known IronSpectable. And one of the very first things we put on that was get IIDs. It's like, tell me the IIDs of all the interfaces that you implement. And that's a definitive statement and promise. And it turns out that those IIDs will actually match the metadata that we eventually built on top of all of these. The other things is that once we got into the point of where we could organize the API surface correctly in terms of namespaces and classes, then we actually had to bring some modern, 10-year-old kind of modern constructs, which is delegates and events and async and overloading, and we brought all of these things into COM. So the version of COM, which we now don't really call it COM, we call it WinRT, looks very, very different from what we now call classic COM.
Absolutely.
And really, ultimately, the insight here is that at the OS layer, we're always exposing interfaces. And those interfaces are things we know how to version, we know how to track them from version to version, we know how to preserve the binary contracts or the apps that you wrote a few years ago keep running on the Windows of today. But at the IntelliSense experience, the developer's experience, they generally don't want to see interfaces. What they want to see is classes that have methods so that when they type windows.storage. You get a good list of class names, a good list of namespace names, and then a good list of method names that shows them what they can do on the platform at that time. And that's the essence of the difference between what a developer wants to know about in terms of their interaction with the platform and what we need to version at the binary level of the platform. And the piece that does that magic is the projection, which is the piece of technology in each language that takes WinRT stuff, which is all about interfaces, and raises it up to the class level and provides a class as it is, provides classes, provides IntelliSense, provides the experience that the developers need to see there, and so that they don't have to be aware that there are interfaces underlying that as they move along.
So, I mean, one of the nice things about COM, at least historical COM, I guess we can call it HCOM, is sort of its ability to be very agnostic to specific runtimes and systems, which is sort of the brilliance behind the model.
Yes.
I want to project into projections a little bit, because it's something that I think is still a little, at least cloudy, in my mind anyway, which, that can mean a number of things. So, can we talk about projections real briefly? Like, what is a language projection exactly?
So let's think about a basic case. Imagine you have a collection of objects. So you have, say, a list of items in a collection.
Mm-hmm.
Then each language has a different way of dealing with collections. If you're a C++ person, you know about STL, you know begin and end and ways to step through collections that are C++-like. If you're not .NET person, you're used to using for each and IEnumerable and those methods of moving through collections. And if you're a JavaScript person, you're used to the JavaScript syntax of collections, which I don't have a name for, but which works through collections in a different way. At the Windows level, our collections have just one set of interfaces that describe that collections. iVector, iVectorView, and other collections of vectors are the single walkthrough collections. There are maps as well. And then the projection takes these interfaces and provides a layer that exposes them in the way that each language group expects. And so then the projection becomes the layer that translates from what is natural and familiar to me in the language. And you'll hear us say natural and familiar a lot. We get a candy bar every time we say it. And the natural and familiar way to interact with language is then mapped down to Windows at the interface layer that Windows understands in a very thin and efficient way, in a way compilers can often optimize the way or reduce the cost of, which ultimately provides a cheap, simple way to get to that Windows abstraction.
So one of the things that we kind of formalized early was what part is Windows and what part is the projections? And a terminology which doesn't come up very often unless you dig really hard is this term called API. Mm-hmm. And we invented this term, Application Binary Interface, as a way to distinguish between API. So ABI is the activation factories and the interfaces and the runtime classes that come out of the DLLs inside of Windows. And so that is our platform. But we would not consider, although it's possible, that the optimum programming experience is to talk directly to that application binary interface. The ABI is designed for and about projections. And so the API surface actually does not come to fruition until a language projection sits on top of the ABI. And a key element at that layer is once we produce the API, which is a very souped-up version of Middle, the Middle tool we've been using for a long time, with all of these new constructs, producing C++ and C and header files and all of those classical elements of native programming, and then creating the ECMA-compliant metadata. And once you take that metadata and the ABI, then the projections have what they need. They can consult that at compile time, the metadata compile time, if they have such a step as compile time, which goes JavaScript doesn't, or they can consult it at runtime. And various of the projections will do at various times to achieve their particular objective on that thing. So it's Windows ABI plus metadata plus projection gives you the new API surface of Windows.
Excellent. And the Windows SDK becomes, instead of a set of headers that really only make sense to one language, C++, the SDK for WinRT is a set of metadata that makes sense to any language projection and is both shipped in the box of Windows but also shipped with the SDK, so any language can consult that and compile against it for the version of Windows that goes with the SDK they receive.
Excellent. And I guess clearly one of the immediate benefits of such a system is very different runtimes, real runtimes, like the runtimes that are like a CLR runtime or a Chakra runtime for the JavaScript engine, can communicate relatively seamlessly in ways that are basically be impossible today. So you enable the cross-language communication, cross-runtime communication on top of your ABI, via your ABI, which makes for an incredibly interesting scenario like an HTML5 interface with C++ underneath.
Yes,
right.
So in fact, we enabled such a hybrid app.
Yes, and that's really one of the reasons WinRT is based on interfaces rather than classes, is that we wanted to reach out to languages that were sufficiently diverse that we couldn't say, well, we'll just pick this one garbage collector that will work for all these languages, or we'll pick this one memory allocator that will work for all these languages. We found that there just wasn't a commonality between the C++ world, the JavaScript world, and the .NET world that would let us pick that one. Instead, we wanted to say each language will have its own thing that will be a little bit different, and they'll communicate through these interfaces that are the boundary points that are the same. And so when a JavaScript component talks to C++ about a collection, it talks using a standard interface that we defined, and there's no confusion there. That protocol is well-defined, and that collection becomes a part of the WinRT system no matter what language and no what environment it uses underneath.
So this is interesting because in both the JavaScript and the CLR are garbage collected languages. One is probably a more industrial strength garbage collector than the other. Anyway, my point is, you've adopted in your system, since it's COM, I shouldn't say since it's COM, it happens to be like it used to be. You're doing reference counting. So if I'm a C++ developer where I'm not using a garbage collector, I'm going to be managing my own memory. I'll use smart pointers and this new syntax in C++ CX that gives me a smart pointer to a smart pointer or a pointer to a smart pointer and then a reference counted instance of my class. You're doing a lot of management for me at that level. So let's talk a little bit about memory management for native developers in this new world.
Well, the good and bad of it, and actually it's mostly good, is it's just reference counting. And once you build the magic of the C++, what we call C++ CX, projection layer, it ends up just being released as a destructor.
Right.
And so, but actually the final thing about this is it's just a destructor. Mm-hmm. And once you reach that endpoint, then they never had to worry about reference counting at all. Mm-hmm. As long as they use the smart pointer semantics, which in C++ CX is automatically built in. You don't even declare smart pointers. They just act as, mm-hmm. as smart pointers when you use hats.
Yep.
And refnews, etc. And so now you end up just not worrying about anything except destructor as your release. And when you're in a smart pointer or RAII world, you actually don't even worry about calling your destructors implicitly.
Right.
And you get into a pretty good, it just works kind of situation.
And we had worked, like I had owned ATL at some previous point in my career. Seems like I've owned everything at some point in my career. And ATL was a great library for getting stuff done. But it was also kind of confusing. It was sometimes kind of difficult to work out what was going on inside ATL. So we decided to take the bits of the projection we thought were natural and easy to do and just put them into the language directly. Mm-hmm. And so while we do have a template library for those who prefer to see things that way, it's called WRL. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we tried to take the complexity that was ATL out of using the WinRT so that you would just see a language and the language would know about reference counting, just in the same way the C++ compiler knows about vtables and knows how to deal with vtables, and you don't have to think about vtable dispatch. We want you not to have to think about add, ref, and release, but just have those happen naturally most of the time so that they're just part of your normal language semantics.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, and you also want to, one of the great things about sort of runtime controlled languages is that it's difficult for developers to do stupid things or make mistakes like leak a ton of memory, right? And you don't want to do that on a device where you have limited resources.
Absolutely.
But then again, it's nice to see, I think what's happening in the C++ community is you have part of the C++ community, you know this very well, both of you, you're both native devs, but you being on the C++ team, Martin, know very well how passionate a relatively large chunk of these people can be when you extend a language.
Right.
And so it would be nice to spend a little time talking about WRL.h with the Window Runtime Library, template library, where I do have to write that GUI COM stuff. And I think it's interesting, and I kind of want to talk about that. When would I go down to that level as a native developer? I know if I can't use exceptions, obviously, but talk to me a little bit about that.
So WRL is never a required thing, in the sense that you can do everything with C++ CX that you want to do to interact with WinRT platform. It's all right there.
Mm-hmm.
But the story of the creation of WRL goes along with the story of the creation of WinRT, and when we started milestone one of Windows 8, there was no C++ CX, and so if we wanted to create a WinRT component, we had to do it from Spitball and tar and all the basic pieces, and WRL was what the C++ team created to help us do that. It's a basic template library that understands iInspectable, iUnknown, and all the other pieces of WinRT, and lets you build basic components. I think the really interesting thing here is, you mentioned exceptions, and that's really the breakpoint.
Mm.
The one thing we find in the C++ community that is the biggest bifurcation is codebases that use exceptions and codebases that don't use exceptions.
Yes.
Inside Microsoft, we have a decent number of codebases that don't use exceptions. Outside the company, there's a lot less of those, although you still come across them.
Mm.
The C++ CX approach is an exception-based approach. It's an approach that uses exceptions to communicate errors, and so it's designed for exception-based code bases.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a non-exception-based code base, your best route to using WinRT is probably WRL, because it assumes a non-exception-based approach. And so that's the one decision point. For most folks I talk to outside Microsoft, they're already using exceptions, and so then C++ CX is going to be good for them. And they'd only need to go to WRL in that case if they had some desire to extend the fundamental abstractions of the platform in a way that I can't personally envisage right now. So there isn't any reason to go there. But another reason to use WRL might be to say, hey, how does this stuff really work under the covers? Let's look at the WRL source code. And of course, it's a template library, so we ship the source code. And I always enjoy reading the source code to that kind of thing. So that's the other reason to go down there, is just to understand the platform, understand how the pieces fit together.
Absolutely.
So I tell two stories about that. One is, this is just one of the many examples of what I think is one of the key implements for success of Windows 8. And that was walking lockstep with DevDiv, developer division, sorry. They started at the same time as we did. They walked through the milestones the same time we did, and they shipped the same time we did. And so it was not possible to build this platform, ABI, metadata, API, without them. I mean, they did an amazing job doing their part of the stack. And WRL was an interesting case study in that, because some of the feature crews that I work on define some of these fundamental building blocks, overloading and async and events, etc. And we built what I would consider grade B crude template classes to do this. But we had to build the canonical implementation of these, or the reference implementation of these. And then many of those things that we wrote early in these processes were turned over to the C++ team, who are the experts in building these template libraries, and then doing that and building them proper. So it was a very interesting collaboration between the Martin's team and the C++ library team to come out with what we have in WRL right now. The other thing I'd say is most of our developers, even inside of Windows, who have a code base that doesn't use exceptions, have really great interest in using C++ CX.
Right.
And you know, building apps, and you know, we even dream of using it to build parts of Windows.
Yep.
And so it's a very powerful thing that says we could even contemplate building parts of Windows and something you call language projection. But the thing about C++ CX is it's a real native C++. There's no fancy managed garbage collected anything in there. It's just regular native code. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that people with exception code bases, exception free code bases can do is wrap C++ CX in a way that catches exceptions,
right,
turns them into H results, and then does this. And there's a lot of well-known techniques for writing these kinds of wrappers. So that's another alternative. I also second, you know, WRL is a great reference source code. We probably don't have time in this hour to talk about async. Maybe we could do that in the future. Mm-hmm. But the reference state machine for async is actually an async.h in WRL. And
right.
So with like the guts of what you want to know about the lowest level of async in WinRT is actually codified in async.h in WRL.
Absolutely. One other thing I thought of while Iha was talking, it doesn't come up very much as an external need, but we have the need significantly often inside Windows, is to create a hybrid COM object that is also a WinRT object that sometimes behaves like a COM object and sometimes behaves like a WinRT object. And that pattern is useful when you have a complex code base where you have bits of it that are still using COM as their fundamental abstraction. And WRL can be a good way to create those hybrid objects. Now, it's not likely that many of the folks listening to this video will actually have that need, but that is something we use WRL for as well.
Certainly. Well, I can think of a couple big applications that people use that run on Windows that could have that need.
They could do.
But interesting. So you mentioned async. We won't dig into the details there, obviously, but this is a very asynchronous world that we live in with WinRT.
It is.
The reasons you made those decisions were kind of obvious, because you never want delay in user experience. That's the number one thing, right? But when you add this massive asynchronous, you know, fabric to an ABI and runtime, you have to deal with making sure you marshal exceptions across threads correctly and do things that are pretty hard to do for the average developer. Talk to me a little bit about the complexity in your world, because you make it very easy for us, right? I'm going to do something on the background, an exception happens there. It used to be, I remember back, Chris Broom has a wonderful blog post.
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does.
What was it, 2003? Yeah. It's the longest blog post in the world about exceptions and the complexity in CLR, for example. And one of the things he talks about is this notion of ensuring you can get exceptions back from a background thread to the UI thread, etc. What evolved? How have we evolved since then? So take me through that.
So
if that's a question at all.
The fundamental way we evolved is, number one, is we built async as a very deep fundamental part of the platform. I don't know if there's been any other channel nights, but we ran an API review process across Windows for the entirety of the Windows 8 cycle. And basically, an API would come in for review, and they would describe it in an IDL fashion, and they would have to write code samples in JavaScript and maybe C++. I forget exactly what the protocol was. Mm-hmm. So they came in with their basic API surface and sample source code, and then they would go through a review with the top architects across Windows. And during this process, they would go, that method call, how long does that take? And so they would ask these questions, and the people bringing the API are the domain experts in that, in networking or sensors or whatever it is. And then they would say, oh, well, that will probably take X amount of time. He goes, you know what? You need to come back again. That one needs to be async. And so we converted many, many long-running synchronous APIs into async. So part of the beginning of the answer to your question is that we made a fundamental shift to go from very synchronous programming to very asynchronous programming. And so because we did not want to bind up the UI of these fast and fluid Windows Store applications. Do I have that right?
Yes. Nice job.
Can't use good that job. M word. And the only way you can do that is to say work that might take a while, a little while or a long while, but a while will happen on a background thread, and I will be notified later. So that was a fundamental shift. Of course, what that does is it brings to you now the problem is what happens if an error happens over there?
Right.
Over there on that background thread. And so part of the async pattern is we have a very standard error pattern for how that thing. So we don't have three different async patterns or inside of Windows. We have one. And there's only one legal way for that error to both occur and then get communicated back. And without getting into the details, which we can drill at a later time, basically one of the terminal states of an async operation is error. And so once it ends in that state, there's a very standard way that is common across all async operations, both the ones we build in Windows and the ones you can build yourself inside of an app container package, communicate those errors in the same way, and then they percolate up through the projections. This is a fairly complicated area, and I would say we will continue to do work on this in the future, but it's a combination of we have a standard pattern for async and the error pattern, and we have a very close conversation with our developer division projection partners, because every one of those projections deal with exceptions and throwing and the context in which those occur differently.
Absolutely.
I think an interesting thing about async is that we talked to the office folks very early on in our work on WinRT, and if anyone has lived through the pains of not having async APIs, it's the office team. You know, every time you open the file open dialog in Office and it hangs for a long period of time, Office gets support calls, they get the data back saying that they've hung, and that's a massive pain point for them. They get a ton of hangs like that. And so they were like, if you guys are going to do this API thing, we need proper asynchronous APIs. And they were very emphatic on it every time we met with them. And I remember when I presented the Windows Runtime proposal to the overall Windows architects about 6 months into Windows 8, when things were still in the will it, won't it happen stage. Mm-hmm. And one of the very few pieces of emphatic feedback I got from the most senior folks in Windows was, I was saying we would do some async as far as we could get, and I was being cautious like a manager. Mm-hmm. And they were like, no, you have to do this async thing, because that's the number one pain point we hear when we talk to people about the Windows API, is the lack of good async and the hangs on the UI thread. And so we really made that part of our core, and we went a lot further on that than I thought we'd ever be able to get, and we got a really good place on that. And so when you use a Windows 8 store app, it's very unlikely to hang on the UI thread. It's very unlikely to sit there with UI app not doing anything. And that presents a much more fluid and seamless experience than we were able to deliver in desktop apps, despite what I have to say is 10 years of some of the best teams at Microsoft trying to make their apps not hang when you check for new mail or whatever, and still experiencing challenges there. So we really found that problem was an OS level problem. In fact, we had to push a lot of those changes down to the kernel level and the lowest levels of the system and bring them up to enable those things to really be asynchronous in the way they needed to be.
Absolutely.
The other thing this brings to mind is that another source of significant pain for the Office applications is message loop reentrancy.
Right.
And so we have we have new iCore Windows, we have new abstractions, but if you peek down all the way down to the lowest level, there's still a message loop. It's pretty well abstracted now. You never handle messages in a new Windows Store application, but there's still that some of those fundamental building blocks at the very, very bottom layer. And the idea that a message could come into these weird things we used to call single-threaded apartments and start running code when people didn't expect it was a tremendous source of pain for the Office application. And in fact, many Windows applications will suffer from here. And so alongside async, we made a huge push to ban re-entering message loops.
We had to invent a whole new threading model. Like, so one of the pieces of comm we started off by bringing forward was the single-threaded apartment, and then at the first moment we got, we threw away the single-threaded apartment and created what we call the application single-threaded apartment that has no re-entrancy behavior. And that change dramatically increases stability of apps. We see a tremendous number of crash buckets just in the Windows shell from unexpected re-entrancy caused by third-party shell extensions, and we managed to invalidate a whole class of problems we see in Windows apps by creating this non-reentrant model that we think is a much more stable foundation for Windows 8 apps.
Now, so again, Windows Store apps is what you're talking
about.
Yes,
Windows 8
Store
apps.
Because on the desktop, you still have to
get
that wonderful experience.
Yes. We were not able to...
For good and bad. And, you know, we can make improvements in the future if we decide to, but for now, for better or for worse, desktop apps are desktop apps, which is great, because when I pick up my new Windows 8 machine running on Intel hardware, it's going to run every app I ever wanted to run.
Absolutely.
Alongside with these new cool Windows Store apps.
And that's one of the amazing things about Windows. The legacy support is ridiculous. I mean, in a good way. But it's tremendous. So finally,
I'm going to try to briefly and say, the team that owned the Windows runtime, through an accidental of organizational stuff, we also owned NTVDM, which is the bit of Windows that runs DOS apps. So we are very tightly acquainted with the concept of legacy, and we did a good job managing that too, but it's definitely one of those interesting things we always think about the past in Windows as well as the future.
Absolutely. Now, in this new world of the full screen app experience, I guess the marketing terminology is immersive app experience, it's essentially one process is running in the user space. So you can't have two out. I guess you can have two if you put things into the snap.
You can snap one on the side, yes.
Absolutely. So about two is the most you can have. There's a lot of rocket science that goes down underneath with suspending apps. And you can just flip through and they get woken up really fast. I mean, these are really frozen apps. So we've talked with people on the kernel team and the work that they've done to enable this relatively super fast experience of going from suspended to back alive. And if you're playing a game, you're literally in the same place with the same sounds. It's quite impressive work. When you guys were designing this, number one, how does it impact your design to have to support so many different kinds of potential apps? A simple data snacking app where I use the basic SDK template, go down, get an RSS feed of news items, and I put them on the screen like they told me to do in the SDK. So whatever, you know, just these boxes, and to an app where I'm actually writing my UI in DirectX and doing some pretty amazing things with graphics and sound and whatnot. Talk to me about that. I mean, that must have added some complexity to your world. You could have forced everyone to write very simple apps. You know what I mean? That makes sense. I mean, we're going to have computationally heavy apps that are still called apps, and we're going to have very simple data snacking apps, which are the newsreader stuff. That definitely has to have an impact on how you designed your system to be capable.
So it's very interesting. At the end of our second coding milestone, there were three different ways to build DirectX apps, DirectX native apps, XAML apps, and these WWA Windows web apps. We had a strong desire to build a very consistent threading model for these applications. It was literally seemed like an impossible dream to occur at the end of our second coding milestone because we had these different apps. So in our third and final coding milestone, we built the application. Actually, Martin's team built the application object, which both enforced the threading model in a very definitive way, and the threading and the window model, which we can get into at some other point in time also. And also had an important piece in terms of the lifetime. And so the application object has to do with how applications come to life, how they're suspended and resumed, and how they become gone.
How they become gone.
Which is different than it was before. But a key piece of that is that every Windows Store application, through the core application object, has a handshake or a relationship with the Process Lifetime Manager, the PLM, for the suspend resume. And so it was really the application object that made it possible for all these apps to behave in exactly the same way, because they have the same core lifetime model underpinning them.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big differences between the desktop app world and the Windows Store app world is that you really have to think harder about the kinds of apps you're going to be running. Like, one downside and upside of a desktop app is you can install a random desktop app and it can sit there using 100% of your CPU and 100% of your disk bandwidth for the next 16 hours nonstop, and you can't really stop it because it's just an uncontrolled entity in the system. And sometimes that's necessary, sometimes it's a good thing. But we wanted people to have a higher level of trust and confidence in their Windows Store apps. And so we tried to model, what are apps going to be able to do in the background? Well, you want to be able to play music in the background. You want to be able to work while your music player is still playing music. So that's a kind of background broker we have. And we tried to think through the kinds of background brokers that were necessary and create brokers for each of the key background operations. And so apps aren't just given free rein to run and make havoc on the system. Instead, Windows Store apps are tightly controlled. They have to tell you what kind of background operations they're going to do. They have to work in the context of a background broker that's going to deal with them. They have to know what they're going to do when the system's in always on, always connected state and not powered up. And they have to be able to interact with the system in that way so that they are not using a ton of CPU cycles just to get a very small amount of background work done.
So that actually brings up an interesting question. This comes from personal experience, having worked on Windows 8 apps from the developer side. Is it possible, one of the things that some apps are going to have are the need to download graphics from the internet. You can imagine the book reader app, for example. What would be nice is if you could invalidate and rehydrate or refill a cache in your app domain while you're not running, such that when the user launches your app again, You don't have to wait. So a user is going to have a device that's connected to the network. We know they're connected to the network. I, as an app developer, can say, maybe there's some way I could, register to say, hey, this app, I asked the user up front, can I update things in the background when you're not using me? And the user says, yes, you can. And then I have the background work that's done. So every time the user is actually using the app and experiencing it in the foreground, there's a lot of stuff that's already gone done, like downloading all the images or the updated stuff. That can already happen today or not?
It can, yeah.
And so how do I do that?
So that's the background infrastructure, the BI, and so we have background work items. And one of the things that we have is the background downloader. And so it's interesting that those also come to life as activations out of the application object. But once you declare this capability in your application manifest, then you're allowed to interact with the download broker, which is completely separate process from the app container process of your application, and then download in the background. And I'd say that this is a multi-release dream. And we want to make apps work more, do more things in the background and use less power in the foreground. Because one of the subtexts of this release was not just, can I touch Windows and have it do interesting and satisfying things? It was about, can I take a slate-type device and use it for a really, really long time without recharging the battery? So as much of this capability had to do with what are the myriad ways in which we can conserve power while we're building Windows. So there were many, many things that we were juggling simultaneously.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can really think of this background download in two different scenarios. You can think about, I'm a game, I'm playing the current level, let's set the next level to download in the background so that next time I play the game, the next level will be ready for me when I hit it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also think about a server sending to your device, hey, there's a new news story or a new news item you want to download,
mm-hmm.
and causing that background download to happen at the instigation of the server rather than the instigation of the app. And so both mm-hmm. those cases can exist.
Sure. And the scenario I was painting was sort of what I guess in some sense violate the notion of if an app isn't running, it's not running. And that sort of guarantees the system. So if I'm using this app and I launch another app instead, that app now actually gets suspended, isn't using any CPU. Let's assume it's not like Skype or something like that that's going to be waiting for network traffic and wake up every once in a while. But you guys did great work there to really limit how much CPU those apps will use. But I was sort of thinking of like I had this constantly running or sleeping and then waking up occasionally to check for things and then go back to sleep, such that when I ran the app again, all the information was there. So in other words, I'm not running the app and doing this in the background, because in some sense, these updates might only happen at 8 hours or 9 hours, and I don't want to launch my app and then have to wait again, which is what I'm seeing happen today in apps, is that we have a lot of this refreshing going on in your foreground context, which makes sense.
So I think there's two things quickly there that I might observe. One is that we do have a background downloader,
mm-hmm.
and so I think that's the contract, that's the background work item that we have today that applications should use. And it's interesting the architecture of that, because while the app's running, the background downloader is running as kind of a system service, and so they're always running with the background downloader. So if that app gets suspended, that background download is still running even while the app is suspended. Now, the other part of that is that once the full machine goes to full connected standby, or always on, always connected, I'm not sure what the proper terminology is, the background downloader knows how to go into a power-saving mode. And so when no app is running and the desktop itself is completely moderated, we get into a situation where trickle downloads can still occur consistent with the battery life goals that we have for the platform.
Awesome. Awesome. I mean, I have to say the engineering in this release is just epic and immense. And so congratulations to you guys for the work you've done on the WinRT, which is, of course, a deep part of the system as well. And I think at the end of the day, users are going to really experience a new Windows. I know I have. It's super fast. I love how fast it loads. Connected standby for ARM devices and stuff is incredible. So thank you for the great work. I really would love to come back and kind of geek out a little more on specific chunks of this. But there's just so much to talk about, and it's nice to have it at this level because this conversation hasn't happened before.
We'd be glad to do it.
Okay.
Right on. Take care,
you
guys.
Okay.
See you soon.
Again. Okay.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.